North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Tuesday, May 6th. Broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, we bring news and information from around the world, country, state, and triangle to listeners who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcasts are received from Wilmington to Winston-Salem over specially tuned radio receivers and via the internet at ncreadingservice.org. All news is read as written. In our first hour, we'll cover news, editorials, and comments of statewide interest. Your readers today are Tim Mannix and
Steve Lord.
And to begin, we're going to have Steve take you through today's front or news as written from the NNO. It's no longer on the printed page anymore. So, and he'll also give you a weather report.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. Our top stories that we're going to read during our first half hour include the national story, U.S. wants to give $1,000 to undocumented immigrants so they will leave the country. From the more local, from North Carolina, federal judge orders North Carolina to certify Riggs as the winner in the Supreme Court election. From Wake County, Wake County's $2 billion budget confronts economic uncertainty. And down in Brunswick County, a 1,300-acre wildfire affecting air quality. All those stories coming up in our first half hour. Your weather forecast, well, after yesterday's stormy weather, we're treated to a break from humidity and storm chances today. We'll still be warm, though, with highs reaching the lower 80s. We're looking for 81 here in Raleigh. Expect fair weather clouds and sunshine mixed from time to time today. Winds from the southwest at 7 miles per hour. Overnight, mostly clear skies and comfortably cool. Lows in the lower to mid-50s. Wednesday, rinse and repeat, same thing. Thursday, we get some storms, rain and thunderstorms coming in, same 81-degree temperature.
Thank you, Steve. Federal judge orders North Carolina to certify Riggs as winner in the Supreme Court election. In a ruling that could put an end to nearly 6 months of legal battles over North Carolina's contested Supreme Court election, a federal judge on Monday ruled against the Republican candidate's effort to overturn his narrow loss. Chief U.S. District Judge Richard Myers, an appointee of President Donald Trump, ruled that Jefferson Griffin, a judge on the State Court of Appeals, cannot change the rules of the game after it had been played. Myers ordered the state not to throw out any votes and to certify the results of the election as they were at the close of the canvass period, with Democratic incumbent Allison Riggs winning by 734 votes. "Today we won," Riggs said in a statement. "I'm proud to continue upholding the Constitution and the rule of law as North Carolina's Supreme Court Justice." However, Myers has put his own order on hold for 7 days to give Griffin a chance to appeal. Griffin and the North Carolina Republican Party, which joined him in litigating the case, did not provide a statement Monday evening, but said they were reviewing the ruling and determining next steps. In his 68-page ruling, Meyer said Griffin and the NCGOP's unprecedented effort to challenge over 65,000 ballots presented an unconstitutional burden on the right to vote. "This case concerns whether the federal Constitution permits the state to alter the rules of an election after the fact and apply those changes retroactively to only a select group of voters, and in so doing, treat those voters differently than other similarly situated individuals," he wrote. "This case is also about whether a state may redefine its class of eligible voters, but offer no process to those who may have been misclassified as ineligible. To this court, the answer to each of those questions is no." Riggs' win has been blocked for months as Griffin's case has wound its way through state and federal courts. In April, the state Supreme Court threw out Griffin's largest challenge, but ruled that potentially thousands of military and overseas voters would have to prove their eligibility during a 30-day ballot review process known as a cure period. Several hundred other voters challenged over their residency status would have had their votes canceled without the chance to cure them. Meyer's decision, if it stands, means that the cure period will not begin and no votes will be discarded. Griffin and the North Carolina GOP are likely to appeal Meyer's ruling to the Fourth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, though that court has already ruled against their efforts once. The case could ultimately reach the U.S. Supreme Court. How did we get here? In a chaotic month-long campaign, Griffin has attempted to discard tens of thousands of votes cast in the race in the hope that it would flip the result in his favor. Litigation is ping-pong between state and federal courts and draw national attendance from critics who warn that his effort, if successful, could form the playbook for challenging legitimate election results across the country. While Griffin initially challenged over 65,000 ballots, the number of votes in contention was significantly reduced by the Republican-dominated North Carolina Supreme Court last month when it rejected his largest challenge, which dealt with voters who didn't have certain identifying numbers in the state's registration database. The court ruled this omission, which affected over 60,000 of the challenged voters, was likely not the voters' fault and therefore could not be used to cancel their ballots. However, in a 4-2 decision, the Supreme Court ordered that potentially thousands of military and overseas voters would have to show their IDs during a 30-day cure period or risk having their votes thrown out. In his ruling, Myers noted that the state had approved an exemption to the ID requirement for military and overseas voters that was in place for months before the election, but was never challenged until after. He also noted Griffin only challenged those votes in 6 of North Carolina's 100 counties, all of which lean Democratic. When the underlying basis for a protest is a rule that applies statewide, a geographically selective protest raises equal protection concerns and the specter of post-election mischief, Myers wrote. Under the state Supreme Court's order, a smaller group of voters who were challenged for their residency status would also have had their ballots discarded without a chance to cure them. Reporting from Anderson Alerts and Popular Information found reason to believe that dozens of these voters, who Griffin argues have never resided in the state, are actually long-time North Carolina residents. Citing this, Meyer said the court's order to cancel these votes posed a serious risk of disenfranchising eligible voters. Monday's ruling comes after Myers initially declined to stop the cure period from happening. When Riggs first appealed the Supreme Court's order to Myers, he said he'd review the case before or when it was certified, but would not stop the cure period from beginning. Riggs appealed to the Fourth Circuit, which agreed to issue a staying halt the cure period, at least until Myers ruled on the merits on the case. While briefing commenced in the federal court, Griffin began arguing in state court about the scope of the court-ordered cure period, contending that election officials planned to implement it if it were not expansive enough. The State Board of Elections' plan for carrying out the cure period would have affected 1,675 voters at most. Griffin, however, argued that more ballots, potentially over 5,000, should be brought into question and that the challenged voters should have fewer opportunities to cure their ballots. When the Republicans took control of the Elections Board last week for the first time in nearly a decade, some raised concerns that they could use their newfound majority to tilt the cure process in Griffin's favor. Meyer's order, however, is clear in its instruction to scrap the cure period and certify Riggs' victory.
The U.S. wants to give $1,000 to undocumented immigrants so they will leave the country. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security on Monday announced an incentive for undocumented immigrants to leave the country, a $1,000 stipend. DHS described it as a historic opportunity for illegal aliens to receive both financial and travel assistance to facilitate travel, according to a news release. There are an estimated 11.6 million unregistered migrants in the U.S., according to the Center for Migration Studies. In 2020, it dropped to 10.1 million when Trump was in office the first time. This new process also gives them a chance to re-enter the U.S. legally in the future. Those who want to self-deport must use the Customs and Border Protection Home app, then return to their home country. When out of the U.S., they will get the $1,000, according to a news release. Self-deportation is a dignified way to leave the U.S. and will allow illegal aliens to avoid being encountered by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the agency said in a news release. Even with the cost of the stipend, it is projected that the use of CBP Home will decrease the costs of a deportation by around 70%. The average cost to arrest, detain, and remove an unregistered immigrant is $17,121, the agency said. The process can be lengthy, including hearings before immigration judges. On Monday, President Donald Trump told CNN, "We're going to get them a beautiful flight back to where they came from and have a period of time. And if they make it, we're going to work with them so that maybe someday, with a little work, they can come back in if they're good people. If they're the kind of people that we want in our country, industrious people that love our country. And if they're not, they won't." The CBP Home app was known as CBP One during the Biden administration. In March, the app was changed. Travel assistance was already proven successful, the agency said. One person received a ticket for a flight from Chicago to Honduras. More tickets have been booked for this week and for the following week. If you are here illegally, self-deportation is the best, safest, and most cost-effective way to leave the United States to avoid arrest, said Secretary Kristi Noem. DHS is now offering illegal aliens financial travel assistance and a stipend to return to their home country through the CBP Home app. Download the CBP Home app today and self-deport. Those who submit their intent to voluntarily self-deport on the app will also be deprioritized for detention and removal ahead of their departure, as long as they demonstrate they are making meaningful strides in completing that departure. In February, DHS launched a multi-million dollar advertising campaign warning undocumented migrants that they will be deported if they are in the U.S. One is directed at migrants in the country, and the other targeted at those in foreign nations thinking of attempting to illegally enter the U.S. The Trump administration has been ramping up deportations and cutting the number of people crossing the border, mainly from Mexico. Illegal border crossings have plunged to the lowest level in decades. In March, there were 7,181 encounters at the border, which is a 95% reduction from 136,473 in the same month a year ago, and 97% from 2022 of 211,181. In April, it was roughly 8,400. The Trump administration, through the end of March, arrested more than 158,000 unregistered immigrants, including more than 600 suspected members of the Tren de Aragua gang. Of the arrests, 75% had convictions or pending charges, DHS said. Borders are, Tom Homan said, they are targeting the worst of the worst, which we've been doing since day one, and deporting them from the United States through the various laws on the books. The Trump administration also has been using the 1798 Alien Enemies Act, but courts have said it is unlawful because it was designed to be used during times of war. Deportations have received renewed focus with this president's administration recently. In Operation Tidal Wave, 800 undocumented migrants were apprehended over 4 days in Florida, DHS said last week. Trump ended broad humanitarian parole and returned the program to a case-by-case basis. Terminated were programs of those from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. But a federal appeals court on Monday denied a request from his administration to proceed with revoking those migrants' temporary legal status, according to Newsweek. The first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, based in Boston, declined to stay a lower court ruling that blocked Homeland Security from ending the 2-year humanitarian parole program. The program was originally implemented under Donald Trump's Democratic successor, President Joe Biden. Trump has instituted a gold card that allows wealthy people who want to obtain a U.S. visa to pay $5 million to get a pathway to citizenship. This would be accomplished through the EB-5 visa program, which offers a route for permanent residency for rich foreign investors.
Wake County's $2 billion budget confronts economic uncertainty. Wake County residents could see a slight property tax increase as county leaders prepare for an unpredictable economy. To balance the budget, I took a more constrained approach to ensure fiscal stability based on long-term planning and projections, County Manager David Ellis said. I believe it's a responsible tack to take during this period of economic uncertainty. The Wake County Board of Commissioners got its first look at the proposed $2.17 billion budget on Monday night. It includes a 0.25% per $100 valuation increase in the property tax rate to cover the cost of the $142 million library bond that voters approved last fall. The bond will pay for 5 new libraries and expand or renovate 9 other library buildings over the next 7 years. The proposed county tax rate is 51.6 cents per $100 of assessed property value. The owner of a $450,000 home would pay $2,322 in county tax, an $11.25 increase. Proposed pay increases for Wake County's more than 5,000 employees range from 1% to 3.5%, the smallest pay increase since the pandemic. I wish I could do more, but we can't afford to this year, Ellis said. Wake County receives about $100 million a year from the state and federal governments. In this evolving political climate, it's challenging to know how stable these funding sources are now and in the future, Ellis says. Federal cuts will mean more Wake County residents will need help finding affordable housing, paying utility bills, and putting food on the table, he said. What we do know is the reductions that have already hit the triangle are triggering hiring freeze at local universities and the Wake County public school system, as well as layoffs at nonprofits, biopharmaceutical companies, and research institutes. Steel and lumber costs have risen significantly, and it costs twice as much to build a new EMS station as it did 6 years ago. The proposed budget includes a $35 million increase for the school system for a total of $737.6 million. In March, Wake County Superintendent Robert Taylor unveiled his budget with a request for a $40.3 million increase in total funding. It included $18.7 million in cuts, including in instructional supplies, teacher positions, and employee benefits. The Wake County Board of Education will vote on its proposed budget today. The Wake County chapter of the North Carolina Association of Educators is organizing walk-in rallies at a dozen schools and before the school board meeting to adopt a, quote, no-cuts budget. Wake County schools are understaffed, educators underpaid, and our facilities under-resourced, Wake NCAA President Christina Cole said in a news release. We know our schools need $60 million next year, she said. Considering any less is disrespectful to our students and the educators working tirelessly to help them succeed. An investment in our schools is an investment in our county and in our state. The proposed budget provides a $1.8 million increase for Wake Tech Community College. Residents in the unincorporated parts of Wake County and the town of Wendell could also see an increase in the fire tax district rate. Ellis is proposing raising the rate by 1.5 cents to 12.25 cents per $100 of property value to replace fire stations, increase salaries, and cover a cost of inflation. Owner of a $450,000 house home would pay an additional $67.50. Public safety items in the proposed budget, adding 15 paramedics and 10 EMTs, adding 2 legal assistants to the Wake County District Attorney's Office, and a social worker to the Wake County Public Defender's Office. Adding to the sheriff's office, bulletproof vests, so deputies will have personalized safety gear that they can wear in a more comfortable and sustainable way. Two public hearings are set for May 19th and May 20th. The Wake County Board of Commissioners, who did not comment on Ellis's proposed budget at Monday's meeting, is set to vote on the budget on June 2nd. The full budget can be viewed online at wake.gov/budget. That's wake.gov/budget.
1,300-acre wildfire affecting air quality. A wildfire in Brunswick County that started Friday, May 2nd, is the largest of dozens of fires that crews are working to contain across North Carolina. Weekend rains helped with some of the fires, but much of the state still is drier than normal, making fuel more readily available to help wildfires spread. Here's the fire situation in the state as of Monday, May 5th. How big is the Brunswick County fire? What firefighters are calling the Sunset Road Fire near Boiling Spring Lakes in Brunswick County is at 1,369 acres as of Monday morning, according to the North Carolina Forest Service, and was 10% contained. At one point, the fire was reported to have burned across 1,500 acres, but the Forest Service said Monday more accurate mapping showed it wasn't quite that large. The fire spread on Saturday because of dry, windy conditions, the Forest Service said. Some rain on Sunday helped firefighters who have been working with heavy equipment to stop the fire from reaching heavy organic fuels on its west side. Crews have been using fire trucks and water to protect homes on the fire's east side. So far, the Forest Service said, no homes have been damaged by the fire. Investigators haven't yet determined what started it. Is the Brunswick County fire causing smoke near the North Carolina coast? Smoke and fine particles from the fire are diminishing air quality in the area. The air quality forecast for Monday from airnow.gov is a code orange for Brunswick County. Pender and New Hanover counties, bordering Brunswick, are under a code yellow for Monday, meaning air quality is moderate, a level below good. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, code orange means air quality is considered unhealthy for sensitive groups. People with heart or lung disease, older adults, children, people with diabetes, and other sensitive people should avoid heavy exertion outdoors until air quality improves. How many fires are burning across North Carolina? The NC Forest Service's wildfire map showed 74 fires across the state as of Monday morning. They're scattered from the coast to the mountains. Some of those may have been contained without the map being updated yet. Is North Carolina under a statewide burn ban? No. There was a statewide burn ban in effect starting March 21st, but it was lifted on April 2nd. Is North Carolina in a drought? More than 80% of North Carolina is abnormally dry or in moderate or severe drought, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. Is there rain coming? Isolated storms are expected to develop over the north and east Piedmont Monday afternoon and could spread into the central and northern coastal plain, the National Weather Service said. Forecasters say there is a marginal risk of large hail and damaging winds along with the storms, especially in the east between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m.
The purpose of the North Carolina Reading Service is to connect people who are blind and print impaired to each other and the community by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. To receive more information, please visit our website, ncreadingservice.org, or call us at 919-832-5138. That's 832-5138. TATA set for Senate confirmation hearing. A former North Carolina official nominated by President Donald Trump to serve in his administration was too controversial to make it to a Senate confirmation hearing in 2020. On Tuesday, he'll get a second chance. President Donald Trump nominated Tony Tata, 65, to serve as Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, a role within the Department of Defense. The job comes with a $165,300 salary. Tata is the former North Carolina Secretary of Transportation and Superintendent of Wake County Public Schools. In February, Trump nominated Tate to serve in one of the Pentagon's top positions, but did so without the usual announcement on Truth Social or in a news release. The under-the-radar nomination came 5 years after Tate's nomination in Trump's first term was compromised by comments made about former President Barack Obama and Islam. Back then, Trump wanted Tate to serve as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. But those comments from 2018 resurfaced, and Tate faced opposition from military personnel, senators, and advocacy groups. A letter signed by 51 organizations accused Tate of being racist against black people, noting that he called Obama a terrorist leader and Islam the most oppressive, violent religion. The letter also accused Tate of discrimination against black, Latino, and disabled students in Wake County and trying to segregate the school system. One simply cannot lead a diverse department while having such contempt for diverse people, the letter read. A vote for Anthony Tata would be a vote to confirm one of the most clearly bigoted executive nominees in recent memory. Tata withdrew his nomination just moments before his Senate confirmation hearing was set to begin. Trump found another way for Tata to serve. In August of 2020, he made Tata Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, a position that did not require Senate approval. Just 3 months later, his boss resigned and Tata became acting under the secretary, a position he'd hold until February of 2021, when former President Joe Biden, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, fired him. But before any of that took place, Tata's career would take him to North Carolina multiple times. He served 2 tours of duty at Fort Bragg and was the chief of plans for the 82nd Airborne Division. In 2020, Tata became superintendent of the Wake County Public School System, but the Wake County Board of Education would fire Tata less than 2 years later when the Republican majority became a Democratic majority. Months later, in 2013, Governor Pat McCrory would name Tata as the state's Secretary of Transportation. The Internet previously reported that Tata was a forceful advocate for McCrory's highway, ports, and railroad improvement campaign. But after 2 years, Tata abruptly resigned, telling that a combination of work stress, his writing career, and the demands of his family caused him to make that decision. Tata has written about 13 Tom Clancy-style novels. On Tuesday, Tata will answer questions about what qualifies him to lead as Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. He'll appear before the Senate Committee on Armed Services, chaired by Republican Roger Wicker of Mississippi. Jack Reed of Rhode Island is the committee's top Democrat. Senator Ted Budd, a Republican of North Carolina, also serves on the committee. If Tata is confirmed, he would oversee the Department of Defense recruitment, career development, pay, benefits, and military operations. He'd also oversee the department's health programs, education system, commissaries, and the Equal Opportunity Training Program.
Moving on to the editorials and commentary section of our program. The first article is an editorial by the editors of Bloomberg Opinion. DOGE's damage makes way for serious government reform. One way to hasten a long-delayed home renovation is to set the house on fire. Having helped torch much of the federal bureaucracy, Elon Musk says he plans to move on from his work at the Department of Government Efficiency. Here's hoping a sounder reform of the civil service can now begin. DOGE began with much hype. It promised some $2 trillion in savings. Staffers vowed to quickly root out fraud and inefficiencies. Often wielding a chainsaw, Musk set about firing federal workers, canceling contracts, gutting programs, and dispatching a core of technology experts without government experience to root around in critical systems. Almost all of it backfired. Sweeping cuts of crucial employees, such as nuclear weapons experts, had to be reversed. Courts and cabinet secretaries raised objections. chaos and confusion reigned across the government. Public opinion soured on Doge, and Musk said he'd step back significantly to spend more time on his businesses. As for the savings, Doge's own estimates, now whittled down to some $160 billion, have proved to be error-ridden and wildly inflated. One analysis found that the group's chaos will impose costs of some $135 billion this year, or more than 80% of the supposed savings. Another study found that cuts to the Internal Revenue Service would result in at least $350 billion in foregone revenue over a decade. It's likely, in other words, that this whole exercise has been a net negative for taxpayers. The shame of it is that Musk and company had identified real shortcomings. An overhaul of government technology is badly needed. Agencies really do waste a lot of money. Some fail in their most basic functions. Taxpayers can't help but notice when astronauts are stranded in space, faulty planes are cleared to fly, and the student loan system becomes all but unworkable. Not least, current government spending is completely unsustainable. Yet Musk misdiagnosed the problems. Out-of-control spending is primarily driven not by fraud, but by entitlement programs, which Doge hasn't touched. Addressing this crisis in the making is a job for lawmakers. Likewise, most of the bureaucracy's failures are due not to laziness, but to rules and procedures mandated by Congress. Extensive research has described the basic reforms needed: flexibility to upgrade the workforce, better access to the technology and data that workers need to accomplish their goals, fewer burdensome compliance tasks, and more incentives to think creatively. As Musk's involvement wanes, the priority for policymakers should be focusing on such workaday improvements. The president has said he wants to keep the best and most productive people. Appointing Scott Cooper to lead the Office of Personnel Management is a good start. Cooper, managing partner at Andreessen Horowitz, says that he prefers a surgical approach to cutting jobs and wants to redesign the recruitment, development, and management systems for federal workers. He should be confirmed. Next, Congress needs to update the Civil Service Reform Act to build a workforce suited to the digital era. That means rewarding federal workers for showing initiative and producing measurable results rather than for box ticking. Staffers who deal directly with the public are often in the best position to see how and why government programs are falling short. They should be empowered to do something about it. Lawmakers also need to cut down on busy work. Agencies are required to submit thousands of labor-intensive reports annually, many of which are completely ignored. The well-meaning Paperwork Reduction Act has paralyzed efforts to design better government services and should be rescinded. The 2,000-page federal acquisition regulation could, let's say, use some simplifying. Such problems have persisted for decades, despite innumerable efforts at reform. If policymakers are interested in durable changes, they need to start doing things differently. Musk's exit is a good opportunity to get serious.
Karim Saramed of the Progressive Perspectives has a commentary: only the united poor can save Medicaid. The Trump administration's recent moves to cut federal funding for Medicaid are nothing new. The cuts proposed in the budget resolution resemble similar Republican proposals, such as the 2017 Better Care Reconciliation Act, which failed to pass the Senate due to both disunity upon Republicans and a swell of organized opposition against it. But bipartisan attacks on Medicaid are still a threat. Between April 2023 and October of 2024, more than 25 million people were kicked off Medicaid in what's become known as the Great Medicaid Purge. Nearly 70% of expulsions from Medicaid under former President Joe Biden were for administrative reasons, such as paperwork mix-ups, which can often occur when people on Medicaid go through the annual process of proving that they are poor enough to be eligible. The Nonviolent Medicaid Army, of which I am a member, is a human rights organization made of everyday people fighting for our right to health care. We share the stories of people who are on Medicaid or who have been unfairly excluded on our Instagram page. We also spread awareness that people who are kicked off Medicaid in any state can appeal the decision. Through this effort, we've helped people keep their Medicaid and effectively oppose state apparatuses built to deny our basic rights. We're taking on the hard work prescribed by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. in his reflections on the civil rights movement. Yet in candor and self-criticism, it's necessary to acknowledge that the torturous job of organizing solidly and simultaneously in thousands of places was not a feature of our work. That torturous job is exactly the task to which we are committed. As we do this work, we must also counter the many myths and false narratives about Medicaid, which keep us disorganized and disunited, such as claims that Medicaid fraud is rampant. The reality is, the vast majority of Medicaid fraud is committed not by enrollees, but by corporations who systematically overcharge Medicaid programs. Among those challenging the wisdom of broad cuts to Medicaid is former Trump advisor Steve Bannon. Not because he cares about working class people, but because he thinks it will lead to defections from their base. Medicaid, you got to be careful, Bannon recently said on his podcast, because a lot of MAGAs are on Medicaid. I'm telling you, if you don't think so, you are dead wrong. According to the American Hospital Association, Medicaid provides health care to many of our most vulnerable populations, including pregnant women, children, the elderly, disabled, and many of our working class. Politicians and healthcare providers of all stripes have a variety of reasons to protest Medicaid cuts, but they do not share the motivation or clarity of the organized poor fighting for the right to live. John Wessel McCoy, a member of the Indiana Nonviolent Medicaid Army and Richmond's Housing and Human Rights Coalition, excuse me, was in attendance at a public legislative forum hosted by Indiana Representative Brad Barrett and Senator Jeff Rotz, both backers of the recently passed bill aimed at decreasing Medicaid enrollment in the state. He asked them the following. I hear about the money. I hear about the finance. I don't want waste. I don't want fraud. I don't want abuse. How are you going to show us that the waste you're talking about isn't the human beings that happen to be poor? Change comes from below, not above, and those closest to the problem must be at the forefront of the solution. That's why the leadership of the poor and dispossessed is the only way to change the conditions which treat our families and friends as waste. We cannot be spectators to a budget reconciliation process on a trajectory to immiserate the vast majority. The 140 million poor people in this country are made up of about 70 million people on Medicaid and tens of millions who are unfairly excluded. In the face of ongoing and deepening attacks on Medicaid, we're coming together for support, survival, and strategy. We're uniting across all lines of division to take back what's being taken away.
America needs more living kidney donors. Here's how we achieve that goal. This is commentary by Stephen Levitt and Ruby Rorty of the Chicago, that appeared in the Chicago Tribune and reprinted in today's NNO. Stephen Levitt, an emeritus professor of economics at the University of Chicago and co-author of the book Freakonomics, is co-founder and faculty director of the university's Center for Radical Innovation for Social Change, known as RISC. Ruby Rorty is a senior analyst at the center. Together, they lead the initiative Project Donor, which draws on behavioral science insights to support living organ donors in Chicago and nationwide. For economists, America's organ shortage is a perplexing public health problem. About 37 million Americans suffer from kidney disease, and more than 800,000 live with kidney failure. At this advanced stage, patients either receive a kidney transplant or remain on dialysis, an expensive and often debilitating treatment for the rest of their lives. Of the more than 90,000 Americans placed on the kidney transplant wait list, only about 1 in 4 in 2024 received a kidney. There are simple steps we can take to radically increase the number of kidneys available for transplant, but political and institutional inertia has stood in the way of these changes. By changing incentives for prospective donors and transplant centers, we could save thousands of lives every year. The first and best step toward this goal is passage of the End Kidney Deaths Act, or EKDA, a piece of legislation just reintroduced in Congress that would secure $50,000 in refundable tax credits for living kidney donors who donate to someone they don't know. Historically, advocacy efforts have focused on increasing organ donation by encouraging people to register to be donors upon death. This is a noble cause, but not one that will ultimately address our nation's kidney shortage. Fewer than 2% of people die in a way that allows their kidneys to be recovered for transplant. Fortunately, there is a better option. The gold standard treatment for end-stage kidney disease is a transplant from a living donor, which can last its recipient up to twice as long as one from a deceased source. Kidney donation is remarkably safe and getting safer. Donors have the same life expectancy as non-donors, and the operation has better outcomes on average than childbirth and appendectomies. What's more, tens of thousands of brave people are willing to donate one of their kidneys in order to save the life of a loved one or stranger. Today, however, only a third of transplanted kidneys come from living donors. Why is that? One barrier to widespread living donation is a lack of willing donors. Despite the low level of risk associated with kidney donation, it remains an intensive process, with a recovery time that can vary from 4 weeks to several months. Donation can also be expensive. Donors miss weeks of work during the evaluation, donation, and recovery process, on top of transportation and caretaking costs. One 2019 paper by university researchers estimated that donors face financial disincentives in the range of $38,000. Programs that nominally reimburse donors for incidental costs are either means-tested against recipients or only offer reimbursement after donation, meaning donors must be able to afford lost wages and other costs up front. In the United States, it remains illegal to provide donors with any valuable consideration for kidney donation. This not only prohibits financial compensation, but also prevents donors from receiving health care coverage or other benefits following donation. At the policy level, we can bring living organ donation to an all-time high by revisiting the National Organ Transplant Act, or NOTA. The legislation that makes compensation for kidney donation illegal. The EKDA, a 10-year pilot program proposed by the Coalition to Modify NOTA, offers a sensible, moderate approach to valuable consideration in the form of refundable tax credits of $50,000 for non-directed living donors. The credit would be paid out over the course of 5 years at $10,000 each year, and mirror the support we already extend to other public servants, such as veterans, firefighters, and adoptive parents. If the act passes, the coalition estimates that 100,000 Americans would receive healthy kidneys from living donors over the course of 10 years. Taxpayers would save $10 billion to $37 billion in averted dialysis costs over the same time period. Meanwhile, such policy reform would also help tackle a persistent disparity, the disproportionate impact of kidney disease on low-income Americans, who are significantly less likely to receive a kidney from a loved one. Importantly, this effort is being led not just by politicians or social engineers, but also by living donors and transplant surgeons, people who are intimately familiar with the process of kidney donation and the struggles faced by donors and recipients alike. Often we don't know how to solve big problems in healthcare. In the case of kidney disease, we already have some of the answers. By implementing common sense reforms, voters, policymakers, and medical institutions can team up to radically reduce death and suffering as a result of this devastating disease.
Mark Gonloff, who is a Bloomberg opinion editor and columnist covering climate change, he's also worked for Fortune.com, Huffington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. He has an opinion article. Corporate America owes the rest of us $87 trillion. Most climate change deniers don't even bother fighting the established science anymore. The planet is warming. Human activity is the cause. And we can do something about it if we really try. Modern deniers will concede all that. But fire back that the do something about it part is too hard, too expensive to be worth trying. We have to be pragmatic, they'll say, and keep burning fossil fuels to make life easier on people. But we keep finding evidence that not doing something about it will be far more expensive and hard on people. Being truly pragmatic means leaving fossil fuels behind as quickly as possible. The latest clues come from those known lefty rabble-rousers at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business and the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Both finance professor Lubos Pastor and two Wharton researchers recently estimated that the social cost of the carbon emissions of U.S. companies will amount to a cool $87 trillion through 2050. That was 131% of the total value of corporate equity at the time they measured, and about three times the size of GDP. This is researchers' latest effort to quantify the damage rising temperatures will inflict on the global economy, and they keep getting more specific. A study published last year by the National Bureau of Economic Research estimated a 12% hit to global GDP for every 1 degree Celsius of warming above pre-industrial averages. They're also starting to zero in on the culpability of individual companies. Last month, Dartmouth College and Stanford University researchers published a study in Nature suggesting 111 fossil fuel companies inflicted $28 trillion in global damages between 1991 and 2020. They even assigned numbers to individual companies, $2.05 trillion to Saudi Aramco, $2 trillion to Gazprom PJSC, $1.9 trillion to Chevron Corporation, and so on. To come up with their $87 trillion figure, Pastor used the Environmental Protection Agency's measure of the social cost of carbon. The metric is meant to put a price on the many ways a chaotic climate affects human health, property, social stability, farming, and more. That hasn't been easy or uncontroversial. The first Trump administration pegged the carbon cost as low as $1 per ton. Biden's EPA figured it should start at a baseline of $190 per ton for 2020 emissions and rise every year after. This was the far more realistic scale Pastor's group favored. Trump's current EPA would prefer to forget the concept altogether. Suffice it to say, disasters, famine, pandemics, wars, and other such apocalyptic horsemen all have an economic impact. Added up over 25 years of escalating and compounding damage, and $87 trillion starts to seem like a low bid. That tally doesn't include the many other companies and countries spewing greenhouse gases around the world, topping the carbon majors league tables of the world's biggest emitters, produced by the UK Profit Influence Map. Are the former Soviet Union, China, and Saudi Aramco? Only four U.S. companies, Chevron, ExxonMobil Corp, ConocoPhillips, and Peabody Energy, even cracked the top 25. In other words, $87 trillion is a mere fraction of the total damage being done. Not every industry is equally polluting. As you'd expect, the U.S. energy sector generates more than 20 times its market cap in social costs, according to the Booth paper. Most of that falls under the category of, quote, scope 3 emissions, which are those created indirectly in the production and use of its products, including the gasoline burned in cars and the natural gas burned in homes. But most of the others still have large carbon burdens, including manufacturing, utilities, and finance, all of which create at least 5 times their market value in social costs. These damages might be cut by as much as a third if we could get our act together and meet the goal of the 2015 Paris Agreement to limit heating to less than 2 degrees, the Booth paper notes. But we've strayed far from that path, which requires zeroing out greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2050. No doubt, weeding the global economy from fossil fuels quickly enough to get back on track won't be cheap. It'll cost $192 trillion in spending on electric vehicles, renewable power, batteries, and more by 2050. Most of the technology is already mature and getting cheaper and more effective as time passes. As my Bloomberg Opinion colleague Liam Denning and I have often noted, $192 trillion is a bargain relative to the potential costs. The Booth paper notes that an effective carbon tax making emitters pay for their pollution could offset the carbon burden. Unfortunately, such taxes are political poison. In fact, far too many governments subsidize fossil fuel. Between explicit handouts to encourage more burning and the implicit gift of not taxing carbon, the fossil fuel industry gets $7 trillion in government largesse every year, according to the International Monetary Fund. Erasing that would go a long way toward covering the $192 trillion. Another less friendly way for societies to get payback would be to sue the companies spewing the carbon, as many local governments and activists are increasingly doing. New York State and other places are pushing for polluters to kick into climate superfunds. These efforts haven't succeeded yet, but the burgeoning science of attributing specific costs to individual companies will only boost their arguments. Everyone pays as climate chaos grows. How painful that will be is still up to us.
Report says Hegseth had at least 12 signal chats for Pentagon business. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth discussed Pentagon business on at least 12 separate signal app chats, the Wall Street Journal reported Monday, citing people familiar with his management practices. Newsweek reached out to the Pentagon for comment via email on Monday evening. The Journal's reporting indicated Hegseth used the encrypted messaging app far more frequently than previously known. Trump administration officials' use of Signal came under scrutiny after The Atlantic reported earlier this year that Hegseth, then National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, and several other cabinet-level officials discussed highly sensitive plans for a military strike against Yemen's Houthi militants in a Signal group chat that inadvertently included The Atlantic's editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg. In one instance, Hegseth directed his aides via Signal to notify foreign government officials about an ongoing military operation, the Journal reported. The Defense Secretary also used Signal to coordinate media appearances, plan foreign travel, manage his schedule, and discuss other unclassified but sensitive issues, the report said. The Journal reported that Hegseth set up many of the Signal chats himself and sent messages from an unsecured line at the Department of Defense, as well as from his personal phone. The former Fox News host drew sharp backlash when Goldberg reported that he was mistakenly included in a Signal group chat in March, where the Defense Secretary discussed extremely sensitive details about a military strike against Houthi targets in Yemen. At the time, the strike had not yet been carried out, and Hegseth included information about a specific target the timing of that strike, weapons systems, and precise attack sequencing, according to screenshots of the conversation that Goldberg published. Goldberg reported that Waltz, who was removed as National Security Advisor last week, was the one who initially added him to the chat, which also included Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, CIA Director John Ratcliffe, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, and several other senior national security aides. Hegseth has vehemently defended his reported conduct, and he and the White House have insisted that no classified information was disclosed in that conversation or in others they've had using Signal. Shortly after the Atlantic story was published, it was also reported that Hegseth shared details about strikes in Yemen in a second group chat that included his wife and brother. In related news, the New York Times reported on Monday that an application used by the White House called Telemessage to collect and securely store messages sent on commercial encrypted apps has temporarily suspended service in the wake of a security breach. Telemessage, owned by Portland, Oregon-based SMARSH, provides tools for governments to comply with record-keeping regulations and laws. Last week, a Reuters photograph of Waltz, then the National Security Advisor, showed that he was using the application to read Signal messages on his phone. On Sunday, 404 Media reported that a hacker had breached the Israeli company that makes Telemessage and stolen the contents of some direct messages and group chats sent using its Signal clone, as well as modified versions of WhatsApp, Telegram, and WeChat.
On this day in history, we had a whole bunch of stuff that's gone on. Some of them, and back in 1935, baseball player Babe Ruth hit his first major league home run. He finished his career with 714, and that lasted until 1974. In 1917, while landing at Lakehurst, New Jersey, on its first transatlantic crossing of the year, the German dirigible Hindenburg burst into flames and was destroyed, killing 35 of the 97 passengers.
Oh, the humanity. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, well, there you are. All right. 1954, Roger Bannister of Britain became the first athlete to run a mile in less than 4 minutes. 1957, the first episode of I Love Lucy aired, was a popular show, and it was one of TV's landmark sitcoms. 1993, Steve Jobs introduced Apple's first iMac. A personal computer became highly successful and helped revive a struggling economy. Well, that's about it for our first hour. We might get back to a couple more of these things before the morning's over. You're listening. This broadcast is generously supported by the Orchid Group at Morgan Stanley. We wish to thank them for their contribution.
Thank you.
Yep, that was quick. You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.